This is Nurse Gizzer News for the week of October 29th, 2018, and I'm your host, Rebecca Hartman Baker. Today's guest is David Trepetich. David is a staff scientist in the Computational Research Division at Berkeley Lab and one of NERSC's most prolific users. After a very short stint as a consultant, he quickly realized that graduate school was a much better choice. David, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So today's topic is large-scale jobs at NERSC. You are one of our biggest, most prolific large-scale job users. So what are you doing with those jobs, and why do you have to run at such large scales?
That's a good question, Rebecca. So I've been involved in a science project through the Energy Frontier Research Centers. And it was a project here led at the lab, and the interest was doing understanding the fundamental science behind carbon sequestration. So if you're going to inject CO2 into the ground, where is it going to migrate to and how long? And so coming up with obviously trying to figure out mechanisms for trapping CO2. And so the geological subsurface at small scales is a very complex, tortuous pore space or geometry. And there are processes, reactive transport processes, inflow processes that occur at that scale that can grow into large scale dynamics over time that affect the answer to the question of, you know, where is CO2 going to go and how long. So I was involved in this project probably starting 10 years ago, and I just developed a capability to do flow and transport PDEs in very complex geometries at scale. And at the time, scale was, you know, on 8,000 processors. Maybe it was on Franklin. I don't remember exactly. But so we had this capability, and the idea was to be able to validate experiments from the EFRC and then to actually use the computational tool as a, you know, another pillar of research and interrogating materials where there were no experiments available, right? Because these experiments can take a long time and can be costly. And sometimes you don't even have the imaging data to get down to the resolutions that you need. So we started pushing the envelope with simulation from core samples or experimental rock samples where flow-through experiments had been done and reactive transport. And that's how I got into the science of it. The thing that you want to do in this area when you're modeling is modeling at large scales. They typically look at things over hundreds of meters or a kilometer in space and then years in time, whereas these experiments where you're looking at these small scale processes with simulation are on, you know, the order of most of domain size of like a centimeter, maybe, or centimeters. And, you know, minutes to hours to maybe day or days in laboratory time scales. So developing a capability to be able to reach those time scales and to be able to resolve those processes was key, and I had that capability to do that. So we developed this code called Chombo Crunch. It's the Chombo is a software framework that I use to do applied numerical PDEs, so flow and conservative transport. And CrunchFlow is a subsurface simulator written by Carl Stiefel and Sergio Molins, and we use the geochemistry module in CrunchFlow to handle the reactions for these subsurface problems. And so Sergio and I ended up writing the interface for that and creating this capability. Pushing the scales for a large scale usage at NERSC was something that, you know, obviously it's interesting, and you want, you know, performance is always something you want to be able to monitor and see how you're scaling. But the interest was, if you have some of these cap rocks that are used to trap CO2 underground, or, you know, they're shales or very low permeability rocks, and they're nanoporous, we wanted to be able to characterize the material properties of them. And micro CT here, like the ALS, can do some of that, but for really tight shells, it's the resolution required are sub-micron and even down to like 50 nanometers. And so, and when you consider those resolutions, and then there's a sweet spot for the domain size that you can model and the ratio of that to the resolution that you can run your code at, and then the load balancing and domain decomposition sweet spot for the code. So we ended up being able to, we were optimized at like 32 cube grid cells per box of data on a domain, and being able to put that on one core. It's probably much better than that right now, but up until, you know, a year or so ago, that's pretty much been our sweet spot. So if you have a sample that's 100 microns, a 100 micron block of, say, a shale, and we've done this, a Marcellus shale of 100 microns, and it was imaged at 50 nanometers, 48 nanometers to be exact, then first of all, there's an iterative process to figure out if you're going to be well posed computationally, if you can solve it, because image data is pretty much arbitrary. You don't know what the geometries look like and what you get once you've post processed it into something that looks like a grid for the code. So we end up doing an iterative process and figure out, oh, well, sometimes we can run right at the image data resolution, sometimes we have to go smaller. Maybe we can even be coarser, but in general, it's within a factor of two of the image data resolution. So you consider 50 nanometer resolution in a 100 micron block and the load balancing that I just mentioned, or the sweet spot, then you're looking at full machine on Cori KNL. Yeah. So right now we have approximately 100 micron block of shale that we've run on KNL, and it takes 9,600 nodes, or really whatever I can get. That's about a 132 cube block of cells per core, but it may not be exact. So it really needs full machine. And why do we do this? Well, the idea is really to push the envelope here, because you want to be able to quantify properties from small scale data for the large scale models, because you ultimately want to run at the, you know, large spatial and time scales. And you can't do that at small scale, it's intractable, right? So to really be representative of the larger scale, typically you need about a millimeter to a centimeter domain size for these images or the rock samples that you're running and doing flow and transport in. And so we're at about 100 microns right now. And of course, it depends on the ratio to the resolution. So you can do more if it's not as low permeability rock, and it's a fractured rock and it can be on the order of centimeters long and with lower resolution. So it's really a ratio that you're concerned about. But right now we're at 100 microns for shale, tight shale, and we'd like to get to be about 10 times more than that to really say that, yes, we can represent a continuum scale parameter with this small scale data using even just basic volume average, okay? So that's kind of the large scale science sort of taking a life of its own, you know? You get another sample and you just keep pushing the envelope with it. My usage at NERSC over the past 2 years was mostly hours consumed by these types of problems.
So at these high scales of processors, you can run into some challenges that you don't run into at smaller scale.
Right.
Is that right? So what kinds of things do you see?
Well, the easy things to talk about there are, you know, queue wait times. I mean, you have to understand queue wait times. I mean, up to half machine on Cori KNL, my wait times aren't that long. Certainly the lower concurrencies run fast, but 128K or even 256K cores on KNL, what was that, 2048 and 4096 nodes, those don't take that long. So, but when you get past half machine, And I have a scaling test that runs from 8 8 nodes to 8192 nodes. When you get to 8192, typically your job's going to run after the machine is maintenance is done, or if you have a reservation or something, or maybe on a weekend. But the wait times haven't been that bad. So you have to understand that things aren't going to run immediately, even though you'd like for them to. And so you adjust your workflow accordingly, because sometimes I'm waiting on that data point to really say, this is our performance right now. And so there's wait times. But then you might get a job that does run and you get a node failure. Hopefully it's later in the simulation than earlier. And one of the tips I've gotten is you ask for more nodes than you need. And hopefully one of those nodes, if a node fails, it's one of those that you didn't need, and your job keeps running. A lot of my jobs, and I'll set them up for 24 hours, the close to full machine jobs, the science runs, they run for a good portion of the time. Usually they don't always make it to the end, and that's okay, but...
You have some checkpointing in there?
I do have checkpointing, so that's key. That's an obvious one. The other thing is you have to post-process your data as it goes, too. Even visualization itself takes a 1,000 cores or whatever to do that, because the data is, for a full machine job, can be 5 terabytes for a plot file and 3 terabytes for a checkpoint file, for example. So pulling up a 5 terabyte file in a visualization tool like Visit, it taxes the system. The thing is, you run that on NERSC as well, but you can run the launch it locally. So other things about running large jobs, there are environment variables that you just don't know about, and you pick these things up either from other large users or from NERSC consultants. Being here at the lab next to NERSC is just a really very beneficial to me, because I may have a problem, I submit a ticket, but it might run into someone and they know what you need to set. But typically I go through the ticket system, and it's a real bummer when you do have a job that fails after you've waited a week or two for it to run. And yeah, actually, NERSC credit, they've been pretty good. If it's their fault, they'll try to get me back in to top of the queue. This is extreme scale computing, so it's not just the HPC aspect of it, it's the data aspect of it as well, the big data aspect of it, and knowing how to handle big data, through the visualization and moving it and managing it, because you need storage. Temporary storage, scratch storage, all right? And NERSC is very good about providing you that if, you need it and you have reason. So these are things you can, ask for. Moving things to tape can take, or archive can take a while. And you have to, with big data sets or production runs, these can take on the order of months to do production run, like 20, 24-hour runs. At full scale on a machine. So, you can't just move data over every time you do a simulation. You have to see it all together. And particularly if you're trying to make a movie of what you've simulated, in those simple terms. And so the workflow for doing direct numerical simulation from image data to analysis and extracting scientific results out of it is complex, it's thorough, and it's long. It takes a while. So NERSC has been very understanding of that. You have to tell everybody, all your users, if you have a lot of users like NERSC does, you have to tell everybody this is your quota, and you have to enforce these quotas. But fortunately, NERSC is very good about giving large-scale users some leeway, because it's really not on the map for how you handle this. The data can be big and it takes a long time. So you learn these things as you go, as you start running at higher concurrencies and doing bigger problems. And I'm sure that I could do things in a more automated way, maybe with some scripts or whatever. But for the most part, you know, I try to, I mean, I'm holding two petabytes right now of scratch space, and that's just because I can't move the tape with HPSS moving from downtown to here, right? But, you know, upwards of a petabyte of, you know, revolving scratch space is something I need.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I don't think that, not many users need or require that. Part of the workflow is a healthy software stack, and there can be an upgrade or a maintenance at Neuriskin, then that can kind of kill workflow if something has been upgraded and isn't compatible with some stuff. So for example, we have a PETSI dependency for our solvers, and PETSI is built with it. We use HDF5 as our I/O format. You know, those need to be consistent. If the PETSI is built without the available HDF5 or whatever, module, then you know, things aren't going to run. And so testing things right after an upgrade or a maintenance with some benchmark that you have, like I have one from 8 to 8192 nodes, it's like a regression test, right? And it's hard to put regression tests into your workflow in an automated way on NERSC, but you can if you can do it yourself. So I ended up running this benchmark quite a lot because it keeps me grounded and I have a baseline that keeps me sane because I know, oh yeah, the code is working. Or it helps identify a problem in the software stack or even a bug that may have creeped in my own code. NERSC is really good. I like the module system, and NERSC has been very good about satisfying my requests on that. And again, you know, you submit a ticket, and if you're having an issue, and things get handled.
Oh, that's all good to hear. So switching gears a little bit, David, how did you end up working in this field?
So after undergrad, you mentioned my brief stint as a consultant, and it was really brief. I immediately got back into grad school because that's where I belonged, and I think I had just been burnt out for a little bit there. But I got back in grad school and found my way, ended up at Tulane University in New Orleans, and a guy I was teaching numerical PDEs there, Gary Saab, and I was just like, all right, I wanted him to be my advisor because this is what I wanted to do. Numerical PDEs, purely for fluid, computational fluid dynamics, that was just my interest.
Mm-hmm.
And he ended up suggesting that I come out to Berkeley to work with either his former advisor, who was Alexander Chorn, or another professor at Berkeley who was a student with him in the 70s. Phil Clough. And so I did. I ended up working with Phil on campus, and we, you know, it was very much an applied math bent for doing CFD and numerical algorithm development. And so I've just been doing it ever since. It's something I always liked, and I've seen a lot of change over supercomputer systems over the years. I think I was running on Cray. By the time I finished my PhD, I was probably running on a Cray YMP, maybe. I don't remember. I do remember when I got my results from my PhD, and I was like, okay, success. It was on a NERSC Cray. Yeah, so I even go back. I even still refer back to that work from graduate school here on campus and the work that I do today. I did go to Livermore for 8 years between postdoc in Berkeley and being back here at the lab now, but I was doing the same thing and even working, collaborating with my group here during that time. So yeah, computational fluid dynamics is what I like to do. And it's not just the subsurface stuff. We've done a number of other simulations in other areas, in particular turbulence. The image on the Cori machine is an image from a simulation of mine for turbulent flow past a cylinder. So that one gets shown quite a lot. I've also applied it to manufacturing processes. So paper pressing, where you have pulp and felt, drying felt, and you have a paper press. It's a very energy-consuming process in the paper industry, and the drying and the re-wetting process that happens there. So that we were looking at pushing water through drying felt, which is a porous medium. And we've also, being here at the lab is great because there are a number of science areas that where, leading research is done. So, for example, battery materials, we're able, looking at transport and other processes in battery materials, which is a porous medium and very complex geometry. So very similar to the subsurface problem, just as the paper manufacturing problem was. So.
Sounds like you'll be continually employed.
Well, the thing now is, solving PDEs is, I wouldn't say it's done, but there's a real multi-scale problem here that needs to be addressed, and that's probably where we're going with this. Not to throw the buzzword out there, but, machine learning can be used from this on the data sets that I get from simulations, and that might be an area that we could be going to as well.
All right, so finishing up here, three things that you would want NERSC users to know.
If you're a new user, working with someone in your group or someone who is similar to you to get up and going is probably the best way to go. But the NERSC resources online are pretty thorough and should get you started. Beyond that, don't hesitate to submit a ticket, though, if you've really exhausted your own capability for figuring it out or NERSC resources online. Submitting a ticket is a good idea. NERSC consultants are very helpful, and they want to close that ticket. they'll get to some resolution. For large scale users, I would say, I used to think that workflow, a diminished workflow, I didn't think it was that important, but now I get it. And workflow is really important. And particularly if this is your career and your research depends on it, because I was down for 4 months earlier this year because something in the software stack fell apart for me and I wasn't able to run. So having a good workflow, some type of benchmark or regression test, if you want to call it, to see where you are performance-wise, on a regular basis, or just even on being able to build, and particularly after upgrades and maintenance. So I strongly suggest that. And keep pushing the envelope, because NERSC likes large jobs and has to have a certain number of them per year. So don't worry so much about burning up your time if you're worried about that. Usually if you're a large user, you probably have enough time, you can get more if you ask. They can figure it out. But yes, use relationships at NERSC to help you along and cultivate those relationships, because it's really a collaboration. We're not just users, but you'll find that once you, particularly when you start learning at a larger scale, you're more collaborating. I find the work that I've done with Brandon and NESAP postdocs and Jack and other consultants who just come back with something and say, oh, you need to try this in your job script, right? And some of those things can be really obscure. You might find it from a presentation on the NERSC website or Googling it, because usually a NERSC presentation will pop up if you put in some macro variable and there's a failure attached to it. Usually a NERSC presentation will pop up if you Google it. It's not easy to run at large scale. It takes time and you really build up to it. I've been able to do a lot of science with NERSC resources. So I'm very thankful for the NERSC and glad I have a relationship to be able to do this with them.
Well, thank you. And thank you so much for joining me today.
You're welcome.